Today's podcast is brought to you by Zipcar.com. Earn $25 of free driving credit at joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. Welcome to episode number 373 of Filmwax Radio. I'm the host of this podcast. My name is Adam Shartoff. You can find this show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on the rooftopfilms.com website, on my website, but subscribe to the show. If you're a new listener, please go to iTunes, subscribe to the show. And while you're there, why not leave us a star rating, a comment, and let all your friends know about this wonderful podcast I'm the only one. Where I interview people from the world of independent film. Today is a marvelous show. It's part two, finally, of this wonderful series of conversations that I'm having with Tom Noonan, one of my favorite actors of all time. You may think you don't know who Tom Noonan is, but let me reassure you that if you watch a lot of movies, you do in fact know who Tom Noonan is. And if you watch TV, you know who Tom Noonan is. Most recently, he did the recent Louis C.K. show. That was only available off of Louis' site. It is called Horace and Pete. And I understand through another one of the cast members who I was married to once that it is going to Hulu. So if you are a fan of Hulu, I don't know if you need even a subscription. It might be available to non-subscribers on Hulu. I don't have the details, but I understand that it's going to be on Hulu at some point soon. So look out for that. And that's Horace and Pete, and Tom Noonan was on that. And so was my ex-wife, actually. Her name's Karen Pittman, and she's currently, I'm going to plug her newest project, which is Luke Cage, which is, of course, available for streaming on Netflix and is a big hit. So that's nice. But let me just get into the show because I don't have time to really do a long intro today, probably much to your relief. So Tom Noonan is the sole guest on this episode, and that's it. I don't think I'll be doing any even outro this week because I've already plugged I've already given my request to you guys for please subscribing and for leaving us a comment or a star rating on our iTunes page. And you can like us on Facebook and all that stuff. And we're on Instagram and Twitter. Very easy to find. Filmwax Radio. And I am off to Woodstock in a couple of hours. That's one of the reasons why I'm rushing through this to hang out. It's a nice film festival. And there are a lot of great people. I'm going to be interviewing Sam Pollard again. He has a new project, a new documentary. And he has been on the show before, so I'm excited to bring Sam back on the show and hopefully get a couple more fun interviews up there. That's it. So let's get into this episode of the podcast. This is my conversation, part two, actually, with the great actor Tom Noonan.
Have I been?
Yeah.
Pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to remember. I mean, had I done the other movie before? Had I done the Todd Haynes movie at that point?
No. You were about to. I guess you were. I can't even say when we talked last time that you were about to because I didn't know anything about it until we started emailing again.
Okay. But not long after we met, I did that.
Yeah.
I was rehearsing that, yeah.
Oh, okay. So there was a rehearsal period.
Well, because we do sign language.
Oh, so you actually had to, did you have to learn it? You didn't know it beforehand. This is...
I mean, I taught at Perkins School for the Blind, which is where Helen Keller went, and Annie Sullivan taught. I did that in Watertown, Massachusetts.
Oh, right. You have a history back in Massachusetts.
And so I had done some signing, but signing was really looked down upon then, and there's been a lot of evolution of the sort of attitude toward it.
I still look down on it.
Yeah.
I'm old-fashioned. In Braille? Did you? I know that's a different population, but did you have to learn that?
No, it was no.
Mm-hmm. Was this before or after the living in the commune, or that far back, or
as I was living in the commune, in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts? Yeah.
So, and then all the money would go into the commune.
the huge amount of money I was making. Yeah.
Yeah. To honor our agreement that we'll spend a good portion of the time actually talking about your directorial work.
Okay.
For sure.
Sure.
Even though I did listen, as I said, and we did talk about all your films, but Tom Noonan as director. But
some say the greatest living American director.
Some do say that.
And I send you the press.
Most of whom are, I hope, are going to be in your company this tonight and maybe the next weekend or so. Well, your daughter.
Yeah. I send you an article.
Okay. But I wanted to get out of the way because of the you already brought up the Todd Haynes film that you just did. So does it take place in a school for the
I don't really know the whole story that well, but Julianne Moore and I are brother and sister.
Uh-huh.
She's deaf.
I like it already.
She's deaf and mute.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear and speak. There's a young man, a young kid who's 10 or 11, who's the main character in the film, and he reappears through a lot of, I don't want to give away anything, but so the scene is between, the couple little scenes we have is between the three of us, and he can speak but can't hear, she can't hear and can't speak, she knows sign language, he doesn't,
mm-hmm.
and I know sign language and I can speak.
I see.
So it's a sort of conversation that gets more and more sort of animated and heated and emotional.
Uh-huh.
Where they're trouble communicating and everything sort of, not everything, but a lot of it goes through me. So it's sort of,
I see.
It's sort of hard because he would say things and I would have to sign to her what he had said.
Right.
And then he would talk to me and I would talk back to him, but he couldn't understand what I was saying.
Right. So you're always interpreting back and forth. And so no wonder you needed a period of preparation for this, let alone brushing up on your sign
language.
Yeah,
and we also had to seem like we'd been doing it since we were kids.
Right.
Because we were supposed to be, since we were children. So we had a lot of practice. It was mostly through Julianne. She made this all happen.
Right.
She got my number and called me and said,
really?
We're going to do this. They're busy and let's make sure we learn this really well. So that was sort of cool. And we had two tutors.
Oh, great. She, I guess, has a history with Haynes, right? She did...
History with what?
Todd Haynes.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, she was in at least two of his films.
Yeah. Well, Safe is a great, great movie.
Safe is a great, great movie. You should have been in that one. I think, let's say every time we bring up a great movie, you should have been in that one or directed it. I was chasing after getting him on my podcast, actually.
Oh, you did, Todd?
Yeah, I got him on.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I think you said that, yeah.
You know, it was on the phone. But, I mean, at that point, I'll take what I can get.
Well, he lives in Oregon, so...
That's not really an excuse. No, well, he was doing press, and he was here all the time. I tried many. And his on that last film on Carol, the production designer, is the wife of a very good friend of mine, and also, you know, like Christine Vachon's been on a couple of times. Like I thought.
Yeah.
But anyway, it went all well. Anyway, so that felt like it was coincidental that you were working with him from my perspective. And I was glad to hear that because he seems like
such sort of rubbed salt in your obvious wound.
A little bit, yeah. But then again, I feel like, well, if I can get closer, if we become closer friends or friends at all or friendly, then maybe you can, you know, help the next time around.
Or maybe be more of a buffer.
Well, you know, then when you're doing, when this film comes out and everybody's doing press for this film, maybe you can help get me Todd in person because he does come to New York when the film, I mean, you know, when the film goes to the New York Film Festival, which it probably does. Anyway, and the other thing, quickly, to I just wanted to touch on, because there's another connection, which I also told you about, was the Horace and Pete show, which you were also on.
Right. We covered a lot of that, didn't we, last time?
No, not a single... No, you hadn't done that either.
I hadn't done that either?
No, it was that you were either doing then, like you... But you, we didn't talk about it.
Oh, okay.
You mentioned Louis C.K. a couple, like, in passing, but you didn't...
Yeah.
I didn't know about it. And then I first really found out about that show because my... ex-wife was...
You mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there might have been one scene where you were both... Where she was the African... She was the black girl who was at the bar, and then Louis and her ended up having a fling. And then, you know, she's a drunk, remember? Do you remember that?
No.
So you didn't watch any of the episodes that you weren't involved
with? I've never seen any episodes of any of it.
Anyway. Is that typical as well, or is just it wasn't conveniently available?
It wasn't available first, and then I don't know what happened. I got busy, and
yeah.
I'm a little nervous to. I play piano in it a lot. I don't speak so much.
You don't. I know. But you almost get into a confrontation. Well, you are in a confrontation, but you almost get into like a physical thing because you confront this obnoxious guy at the bar.
That happens. Then Louis and I have sort of a confrontation too because he's upset about something and I'm trying to stop him from doing something stupid.
Well, how was that experience? I guess don't have to worry about Louis C.K. listening to this. So.
Why would I not have to worry about that?
I'm pretty certain he won't be listening.
It was good. I mean, it was, you know, shot three camera TV style, but also rehearsed and performed like a play.
Right.
So we would go through long sections and just do, you know, a couple takes of stuff and go on. No coverage. So it really felt like being in a play.
Coverage meaning that they would reshoot the same.
They wouldn't do close-ups and they wouldn't do different angles.
They covered the three cameras. Oh, I see.
And they were all on cranes and shit. But, you know, it was pretty complicated. There's this whole wall of, like, these complicated dollies and booms and stuff with cameras on them.
Still not 100% sure how I feel about it. The series, I just want to say that I did watch them all. But that it was so bleak, you know, it was so bleak. And, of course, the ending is...
Oh, so you did see me. You knew that I don't talk too much and I play piano.
I saw the whole thing.
Okay, I didn't
know.
Yeah,
no, I definitely watched. Well, you know, you're in it. And then, you know, the mother of my son is in it. And that's not some sort of derogatory comment that she's literally the mother of my son. Hmm. And then Steve Buscemi, I mean, all the, and of course, Jessica Lange was in a few until
David
they killed
Lange.
Her off. You know, the great Edie Falco.
Maria Ritzi?
Is that the one from Saturday Night Live? Is she the one who played the daughter?
No. She's the one who was in the Louis show where she plays has that crazy scene with Louis where she makes him her daddy. Remember that? She plays the mother of a child who's in one of her kids' classes.
Yeah.
Maria Drizia.
This was on the sitcoms.
Yeah,
the one on FX or what. Okay. Yeah. Because he did that Lucky
Louis
show.
He's the most amazing any performances ever by anybody, woman or man.
Really?
It's a fucking amazing. It's amazing.
I have to go and watch them again. It was also, because remember, we also mentioned Esther Ballant was on that. And...
Yeah, I don't know what season. It was in the earlier part of the show, but...
Okay.
She asks, they meet outside the classroom and he says, are they going, I don't know, some sort of mundane thing. And then she says, do you want to get together sometime? And it's just incredible.
I have to rewatch it. I don't know why I'm not, I remember a lot of the other
She starts
parts.
Humiliated and makes him go out and buy things for her.
Yeah. And then
he returns with the stuff.
Of course.
And she yells at him and then she says, I've been a terrible girl. You have to hit me, daddy, all that stuff.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Now we're getting, yeah.
She's in it.
Okay, because he also had that kind of odd relationship with the Parker Posey character, the Parker Posey that arc, too.
Yeah. So when are we going to talk about me, though? This is a drag.
Is it really a drag?
Well, let's get to, like, how I make movies and why I do what I do.
I was going to. You invited me up here early, so this first minutes were kind of almost like extra.
Hey, gold is gold, baby.
I had seen, of course, The Wife, and I had seen... what happened was already so, but I did rewatch them both.
Okay,
and then I also saw The Shape of Something Squashed, which is your most recent. I still have not seen Wang Dang though.
Nobody's seen it.
Are all four adapted from plays you wrote? All four?
No. What I did was I found a location in which I could make a very controlled film.
Controlled mean minimal,
small number
minimal
of cast.
Set. Yeah.
All in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote a play or wrote a script for that movie, recreated the location in the theater, and did the play like it was a movie shoot.
So it was intended as a film, but then you retrofitted it as a play first
We did it in a way. Yeah, the blocking was the same, so the audience sat around. Like when I did What Happened Was as a play, there was a lot of furniture in the. I created an apartment in the theater. And the audience sat in furniture in the apartment, except for certain chairs they're not allowed to sit in. So they're sitting like when we're. I'm not talking to her. There's someone sitting right next to her.
Wasn't that distracting for the actors?
Nah,
they just got
fuck them.
They're actors. They're props.
It made it really easy because you didn't have to worry about talking loudly enough. Yeah. You didn't have to worry about where you turned and you know or blocking yourself out or upstaging yourself or yeah. So that's how I did all those.
Why?
Why did I do it
Why
that,
that method? Because you're a playwright?
No, because I don't know if I'm really a playwright, but the thing about making a low budget movie is that if you have a $200 million budget to make a movie, mm-hmm. there's certain things you can do that I can't do. But if I have a budget of $100,000, there are things that I can do you can never do because mm-hmm. you have so much money. You can't afford to do, like, I can rehearse for 6 months.
Right.
And that's why I did it. I wanted everybody to know every word. I wanted the crew to have seen the thing. I want to be able to actually just get in there and just do the acting part of it and not be worried about, oh, let's change the blocking now or let's change this camera angle. I mean, all of them were, everything I've done has been with great detail and care, have been shot listed.
Yeah.
We follow every shot list.
Right.
You never change anything.
It seems like it could have actually been more distracting once you're filming, and there isn't audience members now sitting in the on the furniture in the apartment
nah.
for the actress because they're now so used to that. Now they're.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't bother me. I mean, it's. Just,
and then you know, is Karen Silas? Is that her name?
Karen Silas is
was in one. What happened was taking that as an example. She was obviously the same. She was in the play version.
Yeah, of course.
Right, it had
otherwise
to be that
she
way.
Couldn't do
wouldn't
it.
Wouldn't have made any sense not to do that.
Yeah,
so.
So the crew knew every word of the script. Everybody knew exactly where we were. They knew what all the shots were. And I shot the whole thing on video first before I shot it on film.
Mm-hmm.
Shot it twice on video.
Okay.
And cut it together. So the time by the time we did the movie, I'd already made the thing over. This is the third time I've made it over.
Right. What do they call that method? I don't think that's an uncommon thing to do. I thought that maybe they don't do it so much anymore. They probably don't do it anymore, but to kind of assemble it. The video of it on
video. Well, people do it now. I mean, I know Spielberg does a lot when he, or he used to. I heard that he had a video assist truck on every set he has.
Mm-hmm.
And there's editors in there. And as he's shooting every scene, they're assembling it already. So mm-hmm. by the time he does the final shot, it's already assembled and you can look at it.
Mm-hmm.
He'll go in the trailer, look at it, and he goes, okay, we're going back. We're reshooting, shot 2A.
Okay. Were all these films, at least the three that were kind of talking about, they were all written when you wrote them, they were all written rather quickly.
Yes, I write fast.
Yeah, otherwise they don't happen usually.
Well,
or they don't get finished if you don't move quickly.
I mean, it's a combination of things, but I get an idea. I try to avoid ideas as much as possible. Some sort of idea of where this thing takes place, mm-hmm. And then I have the people come in the room and start talking and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do like 50 versions of it until they talk so much that I end up with 100 pages. So, in the process of writing, what happened was I wrote 30 other plays at least, which I still have. When I got to page 75, when I got to page 60, when I got to page 2.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I sort of ran out of gas, I would throw it away and start with another idea.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally came up with the idea what we know now as what happened was, in the first night, I wrote 45 pages.
Which is, I guess, about half the show.
And then the next day, I wrote 30 pages. And then...
And then you're tipped. You've already tipped over where it's obviously going to end at that point because, you're going to finish it because...
And then I wrote to 100 pages, and then when we did the first read-through, the last 30 pages sucked, so I just cut those off, and everything else stayed almost identical to what I wrote.
You say that again? So you had 30 more pages?
And the original script...
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember that we saw the movie just recently, but at the end of the movie, I leave. She says, please leave. We'll see you at work.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, she's alone in the apartment. Well, in the original script, she goes to the window and looks out, and there's a knock at the door. I come back in, and all hell breaks loose for the next 30 pages. Screaming and yelling and carrying on, all this really melodramatic bullshit. And the first time we reread it, I said, it's going to end when I go out the door. All this is gone.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Other than that, I didn't almost change nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I write a lot, or I used to write a lot. I mean, I used to write between 5 and 10 pages every day, 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'd write 2,000 to 2,500 pages every year, of which probably 3 or 4 things were finished, and there was just hundreds of things that were started and not finished and just thrown away.
Would you keep saying thrown away? I mean, are you literally just...
No, they're in some drive somewhere.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'll go, what is this script? I'll find a script, and I'll go, who wrote this?
Yeah.
And I'll start reading it, and I'll go, oh, shit, that's the script that I wrote. You know. I still do it a little bit, but back then I would have to write five or ten pages a day, so I had to have something I was working on.
When would you do that, like early, first thing, when you're kind of
feeling
the
most?
The moment
I woke up, pull the computer over on my lap and start writing.
Yeah.
No eating, no coffee, no conversation, no checking email, nothing.
That's tricky, too, because, well, that's definitely the right, because you're probably the most clear in a way, you know.
My experience is that you're the least critical when you first wake up and you're the most imaginative. So it's two good things. As the day goes on, you become less imaginative and more critical.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of great stuff does not come out of people who are critical and unimaginative.
Yeah. Also.
And never go back and read anything. When you're in the process of writing a script, never go back. I don't even read the line before.
Just keep moving
just
forward.
Keep going.
Keep moving forward.
Yeah.
But that could be tricky because if it's in the case of, again, what happened was where you're writing 50 pages, you said, I think?
45
pages. You're getting hungry. I mean, maybe you're not because, you know, you're so excited that you actually have some momentum here for, you know, which is not so common. You know,
45 pages I can write pretty fast. 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Ben Heck used to write a screenplay in a weekend. He'd sit in the tub with a bottle of whatever he
drank. Gin. So he's gin.
Gin and a typewriter on a board, and he would sit in the tub.
I heard that Agatha Christie wrote that way, too.
Yeah. With so Ben Heck?
That would have been a great, start writing. It's a great idea for
me. I mean, I admire, when I watch shows, I don't know how to say this in a very clear way, but I'll try. I can tell when I'm watching a show that scene that I'm watching was written when they wrote it, if you know what I mean. It just started happening, and all of a sudden the shit started coming out.
It was a result of spontaneous writing.
And it wasn't like they sat down and go, well, you know, she has to cross over, and then they have to leave, and they have to move the car, and don't forget Mom has to write.
Yeah.
You know, and all the stuff is trying to fulfill all this bullshit.
Sure.
You can tell, like, you're watching a Seinfeld episode, and all of a sudden it just gets amazing. I think it's because they wrote it while they were writing it. And I think, you know, if you write regularly and you have good skills, which most people don't, and good discipline and understand the dynamics that make scenes work, it's not that hard to write 5 or 10 pages a day and come up with something pretty good that doesn't need to be rewritten at all.
Mm-hmm.
And most rewriting is destructive and not helpful.
Is there any rewriting, quote unquote, in the workshopping and the rehearsing?
Almost none.
Again, so you really, I don't know, well, you cast yourself in all these films. I guess I was going to say you really feel like that Hitchcock type of director. Hitchcock treated actors like they were tools and
That's
props.
What I'm doing?
And you kind of made a joke earlier a little bit about that, I know it was a joke, so I didn't take it seriously, but maybe at some degree, because you're saying you stick to the script, it sounds like, so, and you don't rework, so maybe...
If someone says after 2 days of rehearsal and says, you know, I'm really having trouble with that line, you know, on page 5, I go, if you have trouble at the end of a week, we'll change it. Keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time they figure out something, then they go, oh, wow. Or they go, it's still not working, and they need to change it.
Discomfort is not a bad thing.
No. And in fact, having what's interesting about human drama is that what everybody is saying is not what they mean. There's always an agenda. There's always, you know, language is not a means of communication. It's a means of manipulation and getting what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So having to say things that are sort of a, not much to do with what you as a person would feel or they don't seem autobiographical or sort of part of autobiographical is sort of a good thing. It's sort of, I sort of like getting jobs on movies where I read the thing and I have no idea what it means. Or it's written in such a sort of convoluted, weird structures that you sort of learn how somebody thinks by memorizing those words.
Are you talking about like a role where they're getting into inside baseball or whatever?
No.
You know what I mean? Where you're playing
esoteric information,
or you're just playing a role of somebody who's in this other world.
It's more that people express themselves in a way that's so foreign to me.
Yeah,
that I find it really uncomfortable to say the words.
What about working in a foreign film where you're? That could be interesting for you too.
I don't know if I've ever done that.
No, I'm just thinking that could be an interesting thing where you're almost having to just memorize language, because, you know, that would force you into areas where language really does become almost inconsequential.
Well, you know, Fellini, you know, he used people from all over the world. He only hired them because of the way they looked.
Yeah,
and they would just say 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. They weren't saying anything ever. He looped the entire thing later.
Yeah, it's right.
People from Russia and Japan and China. You know, he had people from all over the world.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, I had dinner with Vittorio Gassman once in Rome. And he was on this movie, The Tempest, and I was
just talking to him.
And
that's Cassavetes.
I said, what's this like? He says, it's really weird.
I mean, I said it's Cassavetes. Cassavetes is in it. It's actually Paul Mazursky. Yeah.
So he was saying what's weird about this movie is that he had to learn lines. Oh. He said, you don't have to do that in other movies. You know, in Italian movies, everything's dubbed.
And they still,
I don't know if they do it anymore, but they did as far as 1980.
That they were actually just saying nonsense stuff.
Yeah.
Most of the,
blue, yellow, green, yellow, blue, 1, 2, 5, 9, you know.
I thought that they're, at least for as far as the Italian, even though it was being dubbed in Italian also, that they would have to look like they're saying those words, even if they're not. Who knows?
The thing also is, but the thing about Italian dubbers, because their industry is all based on everything's done MOS for decades, they're the best in the world. So if you go to Italy, at least when I haven't been to Italy in a while now, but if you go there, that's not true, I was there 3 months ago. If you watch an American TV show, like in Italy, the dubbing is so perfect that you can't believe they didn't learn it phonetically and did it, because it sounds like the people and it looks like. I remember watching Dallas and Dynasty and shows like that. It's flawless.
Really?
Whereas you see dubbed American movies, because we don't dub very much.
Yeah.
It always looks like the mouths are sort of doing it, but they're not really. They end on the right syllable, but there's a bunch of garbage in the middle that doesn't quite match.
Sure. It's you also, know, yeah.
Like the Steve Reeves Hercules movies. Yeah. Those.
Yeah, well.
But those, you know.
The bar has been raised a little bit all around with those types of things now. Yeah. Nobody cared back then.
But the idea. What I want to have happen when I make a movie is to write something that comes by the fact of writing regularly and consistently and with discipline. What I'm looking to have happen is that what comes through in the script is something unconscious to me. That the writing is actually, you know, it's on the surface it seems like just sensible, like two people talk, but there's something underneath that's unconscious. And the process of making the film is a way to uncover what that unconscious information is, which could be different for different people, but that's the whole idea. So the idea of working on a script and honing it so it becomes easy for someone to do is really counterproductive to, I think, the main reason to make a movie.
In both of In What Happened Was and in The Shape of Something Squashed, there's, at least in those two, there's people have a real-time, hard time communicating effectively, or language gets in the way, or I know that, like, there's a lot of awkward behavior certainly between your character and Karen and language really doesn't help them in any way in that way, you know what I'm saying?
No, not until the end when they actually, and the whole idea of doing a movie or a play is what you want to have happen is the audience. I'm just trying to talk about movies in general ways, but you don't want the audience to know what's going on. I mean, you don't want to be completely obscure on purpose, but the whole idea of a movie is you're watching, or any kind of drama, is you're watching two people and you go, what the fuck is happening? Why is he doing that? Why is he saying that? That's what you want to have the audience, and that's my intention when I make a show. And then at the 11 o'clock spot, as they call it in Broadway musicals, or on page 90 or page 100, something is revealed. And you go, oh, shit, that's why. And the whole burden or the whole content of that movie, it just washes over you. Because you sort of understand now, like when you watch What Happened Was, he's the writer. He's the smart guy. She's the idiot. He's on top of things. She's not. He went to Harvard. She went to technicals. It's like, and then at the very end, what happens is they cross. He becomes her and she becomes him. And it happens in this moment when this thing is revealed. So all these powerful forces that have been operating on them and on the audience coalesce and that's what sort of is the whole reason behind the movie, is to have that moment.
Well, there's the tension and then there's a kind of a release when,
yeah,
for lack of another way of describing it, but there is something that builds up towards this,
yeah,
moment of transcendence or something that's
because everything everybody's always saying is a compensation for what they're afraid might be the case.
Mm. Yeah,
and that's what everybody's talking about all the time. They're always trying to make themselves look better. They're always trying to make them. They're trying to like say things and.
Here's the narrative I want you to have of me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you're writing in a spontaneous way, and well,
but it's through a lot of discipline and practice.
It's a muscle that's built. Yeah. So is there something that's inherent that as you're writing, you're going to get to that part, it's going there.
It's moving there, and you don't know where it's going. Some ways, and sometimes you never get there, and you throw it away. Like when I wrote The Shape of Something Squashed, which I actually sort of wrote and rewrote and changed a bunch, which is different than
any since.
No, before we shot it.
Okay,
in the course of rehearsing, what had happened is that I'd been offered. My agent called up and said, "I don't think I told you this." Major called up and said, "Jennifer Lawrence is in town next week. She mm-hmm. wants to work with you.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to work on the script of The Hunger Games.
Hunger Games 3, right?
I don't know which one it was. This is like a year and a half ago.
So it's probably that one.
And they're going to send the material over, and she's really excited to be working with you. And so I'm thinking, oh, this is...
Biggest star in the world at the moment.
Movie, and it's going to be big. It's a big deal. I don't mind these. I've seen them. They're not bad. So they send the script over, and I'm looking at the script, and I go, what? I'm saying Donald Sutherland's lines. What the fuck's happening? Did they fire him?
Well, you didn't know beforehand that you were going to be coaching her?
They didn't say that. My agents sort of did. They weren't sure what had happened. And the company sent the material over. Didn't really. They sort of. I think they made it obscured enough that we didn't really know.
Yeah.
And so I got this. And after reading it, I think, what the fuck's happening? So I called my agent and said, why am I saying Donald Sutherland's lines? Am I replacing him? And they said, we don't know. We'll call them up. So 10 minutes later, I get this call back saying, oh, you know, no, the what you're doing is you're working with her because Donald Sutherland's not available, and she likes your work or something, and she wants to work with you. And I said, are you fucking kidding me? And I got really down, and I thought, well, that's an interesting sort of story idea, like somebody gets invited to a situation where it's a big deal to them, and the other people know that it's not, but they don't let him in on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the idea, and I wrote that whole thing in like 2 days. Most of everything I say that's in the movie doesn't change at all.
Mm-hmm.
I added a lot for the other two characters, the two theater impresarios.
Right.
That changed a lot.
You're an actor who's hired, right? You're cast, and yeah, everybody thinks you're a chauffeur.
Yeah.
It's all based on this misunderstanding.
Don't give away too much.
I think that much is kind of just in the first few minutes.
Yeah.
So,
but
and then you get shot.
And so when I rewrote their stuff,
yeah,
I really expanded a lot of it because I thought, let's give them a shot. I love these two people. I've been working with them for a long time. But then when I went back to make the movie, I cut out about 75% of a lot of what they did.
Okay.
And left the stuff that was they had so many more words than I did by the time I finished the rewrite.
So this other part of you stepped in and sort of said, this is still an opportunity. Get over the disappointment with Jennifer Lawrence part. And so you did...
No, I didn't want to get over it. I wanted to, like, show her that she's a shithead for... Or whoever that was involved
in making... She probably didn't have anything. She probably just wanted to say...
Can you contact
Tom Noonan? He looks... He's somebody
I mean, she never gets blamed for anything. Fuck her. I don't care.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
So what drove that was that feeling of, like, that I've never really... You know, like, a lot of those feelings in that play... I really feel like I've never made it. I feel like I've never really been an actor. I feel like I'm not somebody that has many, many skills. I feel like I'm always compensating. And, all, you know, that's. And I sort of became aware of that in the course of writing that, how much that hurt me. That if I was really confident in my work and confident in myself and this mix-up happened, I wouldn't give a shit. But it touched something that was very painful. And I thought, well, fuck, I'll try this. And it was over Thanksgiving weekend of 2014. And by Monday, I wrote... like 75-80% of the script. And that speech that I wrote that one of the first things I wrote.
Mm-hmm. That weekend, Thanksgiving weekend, you wrote, did the writing. The part about working with Jennifer Lawrence
happened a week before.
Week before, so this came right after.
And as I was writing, I thought,
so
I got to make sure that Grant Vargas and Monique Vukovic, the two people played as two, I wanted to make sure they were available. So like on Saturday night, I got really nervous that, well, suppose somebody else gets them. I want to make this right away. So I called them up at home and I said, call me right away and let me know that you're available to do a play right now, because I'm writing something, wanting to come over to the house on Tuesday, and most of it will be done by then. Mm-hmm. And I was only like 30 pages in. But I knew that something was good was coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a couple of readings and then we just started rehearsing.
Mm-hmm. Do you get that feeling often? Cause,
no, or I'd have made 50 movies.
Well, I mean, you've gotten to 30 pages many times, and you get to the blank, or you go back to it, and there's nothing. And then you're just like, I can't stand
it. Well, it doesn't... it's not...
Where you get something new and...
You're not... It doesn't continue to somehow...
Right.
You want it to sort of burst into fire and burn.
Right.
And it sometimes it smolders and then goes out, and you have to start another script.
Mm-hmm.
People, the idea, when I meet somebody who says, oh, I've been working on this screenplay for 4.5 years, and I'm thinking, are you kidding me? In 4.5 years, I could write 10,000 pages,
yeah,
of which there'd be like 20 scripts in there.
But that's their own. You're not suggesting anybody else would necessarily has your same approach, your same...
Well,
same.
I taught this to people a lot, just to, as an idea of a way to approach things. It's just much more fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most writing is bad, and it's better to just accept the fact that 90% of what you write is going to suck no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And don't take it so personally and write it and get that out of the way. You know, you write 5 bad scripts, eventually there's going to be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And you get better at it by writing. You don't get better at it by rewriting. I think rewriting is generally stupid.
I understand.
All that stuff about screenwriting is rewriting.
Uh-huh. That's just a phrase.
People live by it. I think it doesn't make sense to me. It's no fun. It's the most painful thing to be rewriting a script. Have you written scripts much?
Yeah. But I don't know that I guess the main one that comes to mind, I just abandoned it at some point, even though I think it was a very good idea. And it actually, although I did feel a certain amount of fire was caught or catched or whatever, I also have built the muscle that you're talking about to Nada.
To go 10 rounds, man.
Yeah, in a way. But...
There's a great essay that everybody should read. It's not an essay, but it's Harold Pinter addressing the class of RADA in 1961 or some.
Is that the Royal Shakespeare?
Some group of young people or young artists. He's been invited to come address, and he talks about like, this is how I write, and he goes through like step by step. It's fantastic.
There's a transcript of that,
They recorded it and they transcribed it. And it's in the. There's a compilation of his plays, Pinter 1, 2, 3, and 4. I don't know if I have it here. But in Pinter 1 of that collection of his collected works, it's in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the preface. It's right after the preface. It's this. They have the essay printed. And it's so fabulous. Fabulous. It was such an inspiration. It's such a great thing he writes.
Is he one of your go-to guys he's the guy?
The greatest writer in the English language, the greatest dramatist in the English language ever. I think by far and away.
Really?
Yeah.
For you, the listeners of Filmwax Radio, Zipcar is offering $25 of free driving credit at zipcar.com. Oh, sure, you could call for one type of cab or another, one sort of taxi company to pick you up, but isn't it better to be the driver of the car that you're in and drive yourself to your appointments? To earn $25 of free driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio to earn free driving credit. When were you first introduced to his writing or his work?
Probably when I was a teenager. I probably saw The Homecoming when I was I was probably late teens.
Mm-hmm. You're in this Catholic school and
I had a brother who's a playwright who's pretty well known.
Uh-huh.
So I would go to a lot of his plays. Oh, okay. I met a lot of people. I used to hang out with movie stars, or he was friends with. When I was like 14 to 15, I used to hang out with Michael Moriarty, Al Pacino, mm-hmm. Jackie Keogh, all these New York actors, because they were all friends of my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I could give a shit. I mean, I...
Right, you weren't impressed.
I wasn't impressed because I wanted to be a rock and roll player.
Right.
You know, and I thought acting, you know, acting, it's okay. But meanwhile, I was watching all this great stuff, watching a lot of Tony Richardson movies, Loneliest Longest Runner, and, you know, and I was getting more and more into, and I used to read a lot of plays. I used to read a lot of, what's his name? Who wrote Death of a Salesman? Henry Miller?
Arthur Miller.
Who I can't stand his plays, but,
Oh, I had Rebecca Miller on.
Oh, you did? I know Rebecca. I've known her for a long time.
She's sweet. Very
she's
sweet.
She's great.
Very nice. And there was a connection. Oh, yeah, Julianne Moore was in her new film. She's Which very good. It's called Maggie's Plan.
It came out?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, a month ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Probably while you're on the set working on Todd's film.
Because the one before, it's great. The Pippa.
Yeah, Pippa something... Lee, the life and times of Pippa, or something like that.
That's a good movie.
She's a good storyteller. This is her kind of, in a way, it's almost like her New York indie or Brooklyn. You know, it's like that kind of comedy, romantic. It's got a lot of different things going on in it, but it's very contemporary feeling. That's her problem. And then, so it's great. And Julianne Moore plays, she puts on this accent. She plays a, and it's, at first you're like, what? Is she going to really do this? Is this her character? She's like this kind of ice queen with a German, it's Danish or Swedish. It's like a Scandinavian accent. She makes the movie and she's like a secondary character.
Now. Wow.
But she makes the film really enjoyable.
Huh.
She's terrific.
I'm sorry. Anyway, I'll find out.
But I was able to tell Rebecca that when I, you know, many years ago when I was on the Upper East Side, how I passed Arthur Miller on the street and Gwenda for about a block further, and I just said, I can't just keep walking. So I dashed back the other way to where he was standing, you know, on the Meridian, I guess, is that what they call it? Like the island in the middle of Park? No. On Park Avenue.
Yeah.
And he was standing there.
I'm putting one on 3rd Avenue right now, just so you know.
Oh, maybe because of all the accidents or something. I don't know. Anyway, so and Arthur Miller's standing on there, and I Mr. Miller, you know, I had to just sell you incredible to meet you. And he laughed, and he shook my hand, and he was very nice.
That happened to me with John Updike.
Really?
I was up in Midtown. I was going to go to a play, or I was meeting somebody in Midtown, and I was up in that area where there's all this electronics, and they sell electronics and oriental rugs, those little stores.
Yeah, sure.
And I walk by, and I look back, and it's John Updike looking in the window at some Minolta camera.
Don't do it.
and I was like, I went over and said, I just have to talk to you. What a huge influence you've been in my life, and I love your writing. And I grew up reading everything he wrote. When I was in high school. I used to read all the rabbit books.
Yeah, I love those books. I love
Rabbit is Rich, man.
It's
a fucking
it's the best.
Book.
No, I wrote. I loved the rabbit books. Like yeah. I just, Rabbit is Rich is it's profound.
That's the best
it's
one.
The greatest. I don't know that I connected with much else that he wrote. Although I read a bunch of other stuff. I did read a number of his other novels, and
that was the best stuff.
But Rabbit Angstrom.
Rabbit Angstrom, yeah.
What a great character. Harry, right? I think his name was his nickname. Great character.
James Caan played him in the movie.
I saw it. The scene that was the most controversial at the time was that he was asking for, you know, to be filleted by his wife, and she just thought that was just...
But that was played by Angela Kummer, or not Angela, but some... Who played that... Whoever played his wife was so miscast. He was bad enough, but it was this woman.
I don't know. What an odd thing to adapt that film. It's like one of those unfilmable books in a sense that the hero is just so unlikable.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, he really is, but you love him so much. And then because you have this opportunity to really indulge yourself over the course of these four books, you really get to know him. It's such a full character, you know. But it's almost as... Yeah, go ahead.
No, just it was great to meet him.
What was his response?
He was like, yes. He has a big white mane of hair.
Yeah.
He's a big guy.
Oh, he was tall?
He's like 6 feet, 6'2". He seemed big to me.
That is big, though. Well, not for, you know, talking
and
to you.
Around,
you're
6'6".
No, he's long dead.
He's dead?
John Updike? Yeah, he died many years ago.
Oh.
Yeah.
He outlived Cheever, at least.
Huh?
He outlived Cheever,
at least. Oh, yes. He did outlive Cheever. Yeah, yeah.
Cheever's amazing.
Cheever was, too. Yeah, that red book of short stories. You got to read all those.
Yeah. The collected stories of John Cheever.
The Swimmer was another unadaptable movie.
The Enormous Radio.
Was great.
That's been adapted as a play a lot, and it works.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I got to reread some of those again.
Yeah.
You know, and then a lot of Jewish writers are good. But those are like the known both for being very waspy.
The what?
Those two are like the two kings or the royalty of the waspy, you know.
Yeah.
But growing up in Connecticut, though, was that something that was like a lot of people were reading because...
I mean,
both of those writers seem to kind of be that have that New England.
I read stuff because my brother and sisters were older than I, and they were in college.
Yeah,
so they would come home at the end of the semester with all these boxes of books, and I would just start going through reading anything that.
Right. So there's a nostalgic kind of connection to that stuff for you too. Does any of that come up in your work? You think? You see it anywhere?
I don't know. I mean, there's something. Something happens, it gets excited in my brain when I'm writing. I become a little bit insufferable. I become like, I'm always writing shit down and I'm saying all these crazy things. And that happens a little bit when I read.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if the actual content of the reading, I think it's the fact that I'm reading something and I love and it makes that muscle or that part of my brain really flower. Yeah.
It's interesting because you seem to have such a particular style that you've created or developed that it doesn't seem like. And also because, I mean, when did you start really writing in earnest, do you think? In the last 10 years or
back before that? What happened is I came to New York as a musician.
Yeah.
And I started writing music for plays and movies. And then I was on this one play, and did I tell the story before?
Maybe. Let me hear it.
I'll waste the time of the audience.
No, I'm not going to. I'll tell you. We'll cut to the last episode.
I was in this writing this music for this play, and the more I wrote, the more they wanted, and it started to turn into a musical. And I started teaching them the cast the songs. And I'm a shy person in general, but I could do the songs a whole lot better than they could.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also had that experience where I was that movie in BU where I'd been in a movie, that documentary. I think I talked about that. So I sort of knew I could act, and I was getting really sick of playing. And so
the documentary is the one where people were just laughing when they saw it. Right?
Yeah,
they
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But I'm not sure how this all started.
Well, it's just kind of saying that your whole style is just so, you know, it doesn't seem like who influenced you would be. That's when we were talking about like Updike and all these other things. I'm kind of
my brother
wondering.
Was a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
oh, right.
He was a playwright.
Yeah. Right. Interesting.
And
right.
Also, he sort of turned me on to Pinter, and I read Pinter a lot, and I'm sort of pretty good at doing phony Pinter.
Mm-hmm. Ersatz Pinter.
Yeah. I just love his. I don't know. I mean, it was just I was very fortunate because I started acting and I really didn't know anything much about it, but I had a sort of a talent for it and I learned a lot as I went along and I was working on all these amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
So I had as a writer I was like doing Sam Shepard and Franz Xaver Kreutz and
I don't know who that is, but
he's this great East German writer. Okay. I did a couple of his plays. Uh-huh. I did plays by Len Jenkin. I don't know if people know Len Jenkin anymore. Harvey Fierstein.
Sure.
I mean, I did all these, and I learned so much by acting and stuff and sort of understanding it from that side of it. Mm-hmm. But also what happened, when I decided I was going to start acting, I asked one of the actors in this play that I was working on as a musician, I said, how do you get a job doing this? They said, well, you get backstage, and there's little auditions. You look for the ones that are non-union or the ones...
The newspaper backstage.
The backstage.
You don't go backstage.
It's
the
New York.
For people listening.
Rag.
Yeah.
So, and I went to him and I said, well, it says ask for a 30-second monologue. How do I find a monologue? And he said, well, you got to read a bunch of plays and find one that really, you know, you're good doing it. And I thought, shit, I'm going to waste my fucking time reading a bunch of bad plays so I can go in and do some bad monologue. So what I started doing was I started writing just the section of the play that I was going to audition and make up some name of it that they would be too scared to say, I've never heard of that play.
You thought of that?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a strategy there.
So I started writing, as I started acting, I started writing simultaneously at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I'd go on auditions and they would say, what are you doing today, Mr. Noonan? And I would say, this is a play, this is a scene from da-da-da-da-da. And I would do either things alone on stage a lot, because I knew I could get laughs doing that. And I got, on my third audition ever, I got hired to play the lead in a play. Mm-hmm. I did that stupid play, and then I got, next time I auditioned for something, I got that. And then I'd only done two things, and somebody said, oh, Sam Shepard's doing this play, Buried Child, you should audition for it. And I said, come on, I don't even know anything about acting. Mm-hmm. I know he's good, but I don't know, you know. They said, no, just go. So I thought, fuck it, I'll go down there. And I went down, and the Robert Woodruff, who directed it, is this amazing, amazing director, mm-hmm. who I learned a ton from. He didn't think I was a very good actor, but he thought I was really interesting and that mm-hmm. it would make the play work. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell me that at the time.
Right. Oh, that's but later. That's not an incompetent booster necessarily.
No, one of the great lessons he told me was that we were about 2 or 3 weeks now into rehearsal, and there were all these other actors in the play had done lots of work. They were well known and in the theater scene, and I had done almost nothing. Mm-hmm. And I started feeling like, well, you know, I'm starting to be able to, you know, handle myself with these people, and I can sort of hold my own, and I'm doing okay, and I'm learning this acting thing, and it's pretty good. And one day, Robert Woodruff came to me and said, come here, Tom. He said, you know, when I first hired you, I thought you were like a cool guy, you're interesting, you're sort of funny, and what's great is I liked you. And I said, now I see you, you know, you do have talent acting, and you're learning how to do all these things and learning a lot of skills, but the problem is I can't stand you anymore. And if you don't cut this shit, I'm going to replace you. So I sort of got the message strong and clear right at the beginning that mm-hmm. it's acting is not pretending to be somebody else. Acting is not doing tricky things to impress the audience. Acting is telling the truth and being present, both of which I was pretty good at least making it look like I was. So I had this guy who sort of forced me into not doing what I naturally would have gone into with a bad director.
Mm.
It was amazing. I mean, it was just an incredible experience working on the show for more than a year with him.
I just like the way you phrase it. You'd go in every day saying, this is going to be my best.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be the best performance yet.
I used to do that when I taught, too, and I taught NYU. I would come in and I would put on Dazed and Confused by Led Zeppelin mm-hmm. at about 200 decibels in the room, and I would dance around, and then the thing would end, and I say, today is going to be the best fucking class you will have ever taken. And they were thinking, like, who is this fucking guy?
Yeah.
And then I would say, we're going to learn today uh-huh. about this, and we're going to get up, and we're going to fucking act, and you're going to understand what drama's about.
So teaching is a little bit of motivational speaking, and, oh, is that your daughter?
Yeah, we can
wind it down. It must be pretty, I don't know, but we've been talking for almost 50.
Hello? I'm doing this interview. I'll be down in like 5 or 10. Wanda will be there soon.
There's a play that I'm sort of commissioned this kid to write. He came to me with the idea, but I'm trying to work a way for us to do this play. And mm-hmm. I haven't done anybody else's stuff in 25 years, maybe.
Wow.
But I'm trying to like figure out a way to shoot short stuff upstate, start a series upstate that I could, you know, shooting up there, bringing people from down here to go up there and start this like a series.
But you mean like when you say a series of short films, or are you saying like a
TV series?
Like a TV series.
Well, or the Louis show is an anthology. It's not a series.
There's the platforms is secondary at this stage. Now, I may say it's like where people view and is becoming less of an issue because.
But also the shows don't depend on the previous show. Like Louis stuff is new, every week it's something different. One day you're watching him play cards. The next week it's.
Oh, yeah, they were isolated. They weren't. Yeah, there was some continuing story. You mean like the Buscemi's?
It's more like an anthology, sort of a loose anthology.
You're talking about Horace and Pete again?
No, like, the Louis show.
Oh, that. I'm sorry. I'm stuck on. Well, you weren't on that.
So I was too.
You were on the last series on the FX show?
Fuck, you kidding me?
I don't remember.
Louis was interviewed, and they said, talk about some of the actors. He said, the best actor I work with ever is Tom Noonan. He worked, and he's in episode 11 of season one.
Okay.
Episode called God.
I will go back and correct.
Louis has been very complimentary to me, which I, at this point in my life, it's getting to the end of my life. I feel like I can sort of toot my own horn a little.
Let me assure people that Tom is nowhere near the end of his life.
I never would have said anything like that 10 years ago. But he's been really supportive and greatly complimentary. And
okay.
But it's a great episode.
I'm going to go back and watch this first.
It's called
God. Rewatching again. Okay.
Just watch my episode. Or watch Maria Drizia's one, which is fucking phenomenal.
I think there's a lot of phenomenal scenes and moments in that show.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
he's able to create that quite well.
Yeah, and he's really good with camera. He's good with direct. He's a really good director.
Yeah,
he's a very fun, easy, understandable, specific,
and it's very
down to earth guy.
Sorry, and it's very clear he loves actors.
Yeah,
I mean, this was essentially what I looked at as Horace and Pete. Though I heard it was kind of supposed to be a Greek tragedy, but like a Greek tragedy, the way it was constructed, but.
Which?
Written Horace and Pete. I don't know. I heard that through somebody because I was trying to understand why he would do this and then kill off. Like, and then it's so bleak and it's so tragic. And so then he killed off. I don't want to give away everything for those who haven't seen it, but the word kill might. But it was to me, it was like, oh, I'm going to do this series. I'm going to just hire my favorite actors, including Tom Noonan. And I'm going to do this thing. And it's going to be completely out of the love of acting and of performance and you feel
that when you're working with them. It's very helpful. That's the most important thing when you're directing an actor, is to love them. Love who they are and love what their spirit is, because that's what's going to make the movie work. And it feels good.
I'm sure it does.
What time is it now?
We're getting close to the end here. We're at the end. It's 8:30. So I will respect our agreement here, and
we could do another one some other time.
That would be lovely. I'll never stop asking until you tell me to stop. Well, and
anything to
you're enjoying it?
Promote my series upstate, which I'm starting soon.
Well, you know, we could do it from there. I'd love to come up and what town or near? Is it near or area? You don't have to tell me the town. I mean,
it's upstate.
Nobody's
New York.
Listening.
I can't say anymore. I mean, I've had. I don't want people knowing where I am. And
sure, I get it. Can you give me a distance? No, then people will be able to kind of draw a circumference or whatever. All right, we'll turn off the mics.
I don't even want to talk about it. Well, yeah. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads. Broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use jiving, ain't no use joking. Everything is broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches.